It's nice to be with you and see your lovely faces. And yes, I have been to Specsavers. I invite you to watch on screen or follow in your Bibles, whatever format you have or whatever translation you have, in Matthew 15. We will dip into the story as part of our sermon today, as we're looking at Jesus Alone, Part 3, or Point 3, maybe I should say. But Matthew 15, from verse 21 to 28. Then Jesus left Galilee and went north to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Gentile woman who lived there came to him, pleading, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David, for my daughter is possessed by a demon that torments her severely." But Jesus gave her no reply, not even a word. Then his disciples urged him to send her away. "Tell her to go away," they said. "She is bothering us with all her begging." Then Jesus said to the woman, "I was sent only to help God's lost sheep, the people of Israel." But she came and worshipped him, pleading again, "Lord, help me." Jesus responded, "It isn't right to take the food from the children and throw it to the dogs." She replied, "That's true, Lord. But even the dogs are allowed to eat the scraps that fall beneath their master's table." "Dear woman," Jesus said to her, "your faith is great. Your request is granted." And her daughter was instantly healed. May God bless us as we consider Jesus Alone, Point 3. So, out traveling with friends, we would find ourselves, I would say lost, they would just say just a little bit disorientated. And from time to time, they would call on some sort of skill that I had, hopefully still have, although I struggle a little bit occasionally now, of somehow finding our way back. I would tend to have a good skill, knack, whatever, of being able to look at a map and kind of memorize a little bit of where things are. And while we're out and about, which way do we go, Nathan? Oh, well, I think it's that way, and then right, and then left, and then it's back onto the main road. Ah, brilliant. And somehow, because of this ability that I had, they started calling me Satnav. Satnav. Which way, Satnav? Oh, it's that way. And stop calling me. Somehow managing to find our way back to the way that we needed to go. I know there's a phrase, a saying, isn't there? All roads lead to Rome. What does it mean? What does it mean when someone uses that phrase, all roads lead to Rome? What do they mean? Are they literally meaning all roads lead to Rome? What does that term of phrase mean? Different paths, same destination. I like the economy of words there. That's very good. Different paths, same destination. Is that what you were going to say? They lead to the right destination. Okay. All roads lead to Rome. Sorry? You'll get there in the end. Yeah, depends if you have Satnav with you. I remember listening to, and I think reading some of Maurice Fendon's material, and I can remember hearing him saying that he would go around place to place and ask people, what is a fan? And I don't think he was talking about a big motor with blades and blowing air through the air, but a fan as in like a football fan. So I'm going to ask you the same question. What is a fan? Like a football fan or any other fan? A supporter. Okay. Follower. Looking for words of wisdom, Melody. Okay, you've used the longer word there. Fan is a fanatic, and maybe nowadays we're comfortable maybe with more of the reference of a fan, a football fan, for instance. But when we think about fanatic, maybe we think of it as a negative connotation. But someone who is a fan is a fanatic about something. Okay, single-minded devotion. Maurice Fendon concluded in his asking the question time and time again, he concluded with something like this, that a fan is someone, a fanatic, is someone who doesn't matter what it is that you start with, you know what they're going to end up talking about. Football fan, it doesn't matter what they're going to start with, they're going to end up talking about Arsenal or some other team that loses. Sorry, are there Arsenal supporters in the audience? it doesn't matter where you start, a fan, a fanatic, is going to end up in a certain place. All roads lead to Rome. Nathan the Satnav, get us out of here, put us on the right road. I watched a film a few weeks ago. I don't often get a chance, certainly not with the rest of my family, to sit down and watch a film. And maybe I should try and cut in a little bit of time from time to time. But it was a Christian film. And these films are becoming more and more available, and some of them pretty good nowadays. And this one I hadn't seen. It's a couple of years old. Maybe all of you have seen it. Already. It's called Do You Believe? And I won't spoil it all for you, but it follows a number of people's lives and how they crisscross and interact and people sharing faith and so on. But there's one point in the film. One of the characters talking with someone else, and maybe it's not exactly their words, but they pose this question. And they say, if you were accused of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence? If you were accused of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence? You know, Christianity is not something that we pass on to people by some kind of osmosis. Christianity is something that I'm going to expose one of my hobby horses and annoyances with you now, and I'm sorry if you've expressed this to me before, maybe this isn't you at all, but it does rile me a little bit. And I know not all of us have the same kind of sharing abilities. Some are very good at conversational and some are better at other forms of serving other people and showing the love of Jesus to other people. But it does get me all prickly when people say, well, I'm just going to be a good kind of person. And people are going to know that I'm a Christian just because I'm a good kind of person. Well, I have something to tell you, because there are a lot of people out there that are not Christians, that are not God followers, that are very good people. just being good and hoping that through osmosis you're going to be able to influence other people isn't going to work. At some point, as my Bible says, we faith comes by hearing. At some point, people are going to have to hear about this faith that we profess in. And maybe at that point, we can ask that question. If that person accused me of being a Christian, have I given them enough evidence? Jesus alone, part three, is today. And as I said, I realized that maybe instead of part, I should have called them point three. Point one and two. Well, point one was thought about Jesus being the most significant person in history. And if Jesus is the most significant person in history, according to Time magazine, is Jesus the most significant person in my history? And if so, what am I going to do about it? And part two, point two, we looked at Mary and Martha, and we just jostled with the idea of, well, if we have access to Jesus, do we, like Mary, sit at the feet of Jesus and not allow the distraction of detail to get us so caught up with things? Martha was so busy, and rightly so. She had lots of things to do. But she was so distracted with the busyness of life, the details of life, that she didn't take that time out to sit with Jesus. Point three that I'm sharing with you now is when we have put Jesus first in our lives, when we come to that point of saying, Jesus alone is all who I need and it's all who I want, then we need to have a beeline faith. Telling you the answer now in case you fall asleep in the next 10 or 15 minutes. We need to have a beeline faith. You know, Charles Blondin didn't have any other option other than carry on walking across his tightrope that we talked about in our children's story. But we need to have that kind of tightrope thing of being so connected with Jesus that we are going to keep in balance in life because of our connection, our oneness with Jesus. And then we're going to have that beeline faith that doesn't matter where we start, we know where we're going. We're going towards Jesus. Our scripture reading happened outside of this body of God's chosen people, this place, this land, this people that were God followers. Jesus had to take his disciples, his followers, out of the Jewish area up towards Tyre and Sidon. From Galilee, this is probably, 30 or 40 miles northwest, hitting the coast. And between Tyre and Sidon, you've got another 20, 25 miles journey between the two places. Certainly by the time you get on to Sidon, which is further north than Tyre, this is outside of the promised land. So in a Hebraic way of thinking, you know, this is definitely Gentile land. This is people that are not of God's promise. And Jesus, I'll leave you to read the stories around in Matthew, but Jesus again takes his followers outside of this area of influence by these other religious leaders who Jesus is having problems with. And he has to take his followers out to this non-God following, pagan area in order to teach them a lesson. So we read the story. Jesus went from Galilee, he went up to Tyre and Sidon, and a lady comes to him. It seems as though they were most likely walking along, moving along. And what do we know about this story, and what do we know about these characters? The way that I had it translated and read, it just said a Gentile woman, and maybe in your translations it's got a Canaanite woman. What do we know about Canaanites? Anyone?
They were there before the Jews,
before the Hebrew people arrived. They were already occupying this promised land. When Moses, hundreds of years before, when Moses led the people out of Egypt, up towards this promised land, this people of promise towards their promised land. And what was it that God told these people as they were eventually about to enter this promised land? What did God say about the Canaanites? Have nothing to do with them. I'll drive them out. But don't mix with them. Don't mingle with their faith systems and so on, because it's all going to end badly. That's my paraphrase of what God was saying. Now that's it in a nutshell. So we have, as Jesus with his followers, this little Hebraic Jewish group walking along, and they're going up to this Tyre and Sidon. They're going for a day at the beach. Tyre and Sidon's on the coast. And this woman, this Canaanite woman, this woman that is not of promise, she's a Canaanite. We have nothing to do with Canaanites. And she's a woman. And then in the Hebraic Jewish system, you know, that was second rate. It's not something I advocate. So a woman, a Canaanite woman, approaches Jesus. Someone who is in a place that they would not normally go. They don't really associate with these people. But she approaches Jesus. And what does she say to him? What does she say? Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. How did she know? How did she know? Did she get the email? Somehow or another, she's got this message. She's heard these stories that there is this guy that's going around 30, 40 miles away, and he's healing people. And people are getting well. And things are amazing. Things are happening. And word has it that maybe he's heading in our direction. And somehow or another, she knows that this is the man that she's heard about. She can see this little entourage of people, and she rushes to him, and she says, have mercy on me. And it's not actually on her, is it? Because she asks for a favor for her daughter. Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. She is recognizing Jesus for who he is, and the Jews haven't even done that. Have mercy on me, for my daughter is possessed with a demon who torments her severely. So what does Jesus do? You know, if we read back a few chapters, Jesus has previously, in chapter 10 of Matthew, Jesus has previously sent out his disciples, part of his entourage. He sent them out, and he said to them at that point, don't go to the Gentiles, go to the lost people of Israel and heal their sick and make people well. And they go out and they do that. Wow, imagine being part of that. To being given that Holy Spirit power and being sent by Jesus and to go out. And imagine going off and then coming back and the kind of conversations that would have been had then and chatting with each other. And, oh, well, I went to this village and I went to this place and God was able to use me like this. And this is amazing and this is fantastic. They've had this experience. And now they're outside of their territory, kind of in a foreign land, with people we don't mix with, because they're not like us. They're not the people of promise. So what's Jesus going to do? Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David, for my daughter is possessed by a demon that torments her severely. And Jesus gave her no reply. Not even a word. He ignores her. Good for you, Jesus. That's what we were expecting. That's the kind of thing that the disciples must have been thinking, because they kind of follow on with that kind of train of thought. Because they would not have anything to do with a woman, and certainly not a Canaanite woman. They're not one of us. Then the disciples urged him to send her away. Tell her to go away because she's bothering us with her begging. Jesus had previously sent these people out to go and proclaim the good news to the lost people of Israel. And now Jesus has gone into the others, the Gentiles, the Canaanites. And she's coming to Jesus. And at first he says nothing. And the disciples, picking up on this is what we would expect from any good Jewish person towards these kind of people, they start saying to Jesus, get rid of her. She's bugging us. Then Jesus said to the woman, I was sent only to help God's lost sheep, the people of Israel. I would have thought that any one of us could have forgiven her at that point, to turn around and give up. Jesus didn't say anything to me at first, and then when I came and begged her even more, and I'm aware that his followers are saying, look, just get rid of her. She's a nuisance. And then Jesus says, I wasn't here. I didn't get sent for you. I think that I would forgive her for saying, you know what? Okay, I'm out of here. But what does she do? She worshipped Jesus. Even though it seems as though Jesus is ignoring her, not giving her the answer that she was hoping for, that she was desperate for, she, for this woman, this Canaanite woman, to come to ask a Jewish rabbi, a leader, to come and heal her daughter, that was desperate. You know, for those people that are the people that are really into Star Wars and so on, I don't know, I won't ask for a show of hands as such, but for those that might know what I'm talking about, there is a clip in the first ever Star Wars back in 77 or whenever it came, 78 when it came out, there is a clip there that has this robot that's being cleaned up, and suddenly in cleaning this robot up, it projects this little kind of video thing, so a 3D animated video, a bit like what we got the words and stuff that come up on our screen, but this is a 3D, and there this guy that's cleaning up, Luke Skywalker, he's cleaning up this robot, and suddenly this woman appears, Princess Leia, and all that they get at first is her saying, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. And they eventually get a bit more of the clip. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. This is like this. This happened years before Star Wars. This is the Princess Leia of the time, this Canaanite woman coming to Jesus and saying, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, help me, Jesus, help me, son of David, you're my only hope. I can't go anywhere else. At first, Jesus seems to be quiet and ignores her. And she persists. And in her persistence, she has this beeline faith that it doesn't matter that she was not of a people of promise. It doesn't matter where she was starting from. She was looking to Jesus, and she knew that Jesus was her hope. And she knew that it doesn't matter which road that she's going on, her Rome was Jesus. She has this beeline faith, and she was not going to stop until she got to Jesus, and until she got this power of the promise that he offers. Help me, Jesus. You're my only hope. And then Jesus says, it isn't right to take food from the children and throw it to the dogs. Really, Jesus? I mean, I've had some put-downs in my life, but that's a pretty big one. I mean, the implication, what is it that Jesus is saying, basically? It's not good to take food from the children and give it to the dogs. He's saying, you're a dog. You're a dog. But she seems totally unswayed by it. And in her response, it's amazing. So many Bible characters I can't wait to meet. That's true, Lord. She doesn't give up on her acknowledgement of who Jesus is. That's true, Lord, but even the dogs are allowed to eat the scraps that fall beneath their master's table. Their crumbs that fall under the table, as some translations put it. In Mark, his gospel, he writes that the scratch from the plate, that sounds even more fulfilling. You know, there might be more that's still left on the plate than falls on the floor. In the book Desire of Ages, page 401, there is this suggestion that she, that is the Canaanite woman, saw a compassion that he, Jesus, could not hide. Even in his silence, even in his lesson that he was trying to teach his disciples, in his response to this woman, he still had this compassion that he couldn't hide. And the suggestion is, she saw it. That's why she had this beeline faith that was not going to stop her from keeping coming after Jesus. It's the same kind of faith that another woman who had an issue of blood, hemorrhaging, whatever, in Matthew, some chapters before, in Matthew chapter 9, maybe you know that story as well, that she had this problem and no one else seemed to be able to fix it, and she came after Jesus thinking, if only I can have this beeline faith for Jesus, if only I can just reach out and touch the hem of his garment and I'll be healed. If only. And she would stop at nothing. She had that beeline faith. It's interesting that both of these women who had this beeline faith expressed their beeline faith in public. It was in front of a crowd. They didn't wait to speak to Jesus quietly, privately. They were ready to express the kind of beeline faith that they had in front of anyone. So when we say we have Jesus in our lives, Jesus alone, point three, is we have a beeline faith. Doesn't matter even if Jesus seems to be silent, even if it doesn't seem as though things are working out. Will we be like this woman? Even if God seems to be quiet, I'm going to worship him and worship him and come after him with a beeline faith. There's a song just to give a bit of balance to football supporters, football fans. That even when Jesus seems to be silent, when things seem not to be going well, to keep going. Keep going with that beeline faith. To walk on towards Jesus. And yes, the Jury and the Pacemaker song that Liverpool fans sing has this kind of sentiment. I wonder if any time you hear this song again, you're going to think about having a beeline faith for Jesus. When you walk through the storm, hold your head up high. Even when Jesus doesn't answer you, hold your head up high. And don't be afraid of the dark. And don't be afraid of the crowds.
At the end of the storm, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver song of a lark. Walk on through the wind, walk on through the rain. Though your dreams be tossed and blown, though your daughter be possessed by an evil spirit, walk on, walk on, with hope in your heart, with a beeline faith for Jesus. And you'll never walk alone. If you were accused of having a beeline faith for Jesus, would there be enough evidence?